Computer Viruses, Artificial Life, and the Origin of Life by Robert C. Newman. We want to think about the origin of life. Many talk today as though life came about by purely natural processes, and it's only a matter of time until we learn how it happened. However, here we suggest that life is far more complex than most people think, and it is hardly likely to have happened by chance. A little cartoon here from the newspaper, Scott Adams' cartoon. Wow, according to my computer simulation, it should be possible to create new life forms from common household chemicals. This raises some thorny issues, says Dogbert. You mean legal, ethical, and religious issues? I was thinking about parking places. For our topics of discussion today, in thinking about the complexity of life, we're going to take a different tactic than as usual. We're going to look at computers rather than biology. We will look at computer viruses and at artificial life. Start with computer viruses. What are computer viruses? Well, they're computer programs which invade a computer and try to take over its functions, rather like biological viruses do with human cells or animal cells or plant cells. Most of us with computer experience have had to deal with such viruses from time to time. There's an excellent discussion in Mark Ludwig's book, Computer Viruses, Artificial Life, and Evolution. As Ludwig points out, computer viruses are closer to artificial life than anything else humans have ever made. They're able to reproduce. They can often hide from predators. They can survive outside captivity. So when we think about the origin of life, it might be helpful to think about the origin of computer viruses. Nobody claims they arose by chance. They're designed by intelligent, if rather malevolent, creators. How likely would it be for something as complex as a computer virus to arise by chance in the computer environment? Well, Ludwig was interested in this particular question, and so in 1993 he sponsored his first international virus writing contest. I don't know whether he's sponsoring the second or third one since then or not. Conditions of the contest were that the contestants should try to devise the shortest virus possible that has certain minimal functions. In his book, Ludwig gives a sample of what he had in mind, and then the grand prize winner and several runners-up. All of these are over 100 bytes in length. How likely is such a computer virus to arise by chance? Well, the shortest virus won this contest was 101 bytes. Using the length of byte that was in use at that particular time, I think we were still in the 16-bit bytes at that point, maybe only the 8-bit bytes. Ludwig points out there are 10 to the 243 possible files of length 101 bytes. If we have all 100 million personal computers in the world run full time and have them making only 101 byte files at 1,000 files per second, the probability in the history of the universe that we will make the particular one which won the contest is 4 times 10 to the minus 214. Very low probability. If every elementary particle in the universe or such a personal computer, then the probability rises to 6 times 10 to minus 100, still a pretty small probability. So we can say, in summarizing our very quick discussion of computer viruses, even very simple computer viruses are very complex from the viewpoint of random assembly. So we can see why no one thinks that computer viruses formed by accident. But perhaps some other form of artificial life will show us how this could have happened. And so that brings us to the subject, more general subject, of artificial life. What is artificial life? Well, artificial life may be defined as attempts to mimic or reproduce life by human ingenuity. The term is commonly used today for attempts to mimic life by computer simulation rather than by building up life from its basic biological components. First attempts in this direction began over 50 years ago when John von Neumann, one of the pioneers in the development of computers, sought to design a self-reproducing automaton. He imagined a rectangular array of identical computer chips, each wired to four neighbors. Although these chips are identical, the chips will behave differently depending on what operational state each one of these are in. So here's a little diagram to help us imagine what these are. So chips with four wires coming out of each of them, and each connected to four neighbors, and then this array disappears off the scene, off the screen to the left and right and top and bottom, etc., though not shown here. We imagine that the state each particular chip is in is displayed on its surface by, say, a LED display, although such displays did not exist in von Neumann's time. Von Neumann then sought to design a array of these chips with specifying what each operational state would be do, and such an array that would, if you like, build a copy of itself in the neighborhood near itself. His idea was this, that part of the array would be a memory control, we see at the bottom left here in this diagram, and that it would read information off a long linear array, which we might call an instruction tape, although the tape would not actually move. There would be a technique of moving the information down the tape into the location of the memory control, so that the memory control could read it then. The memory control would send information to a construction unit, and the construction unit would assemble another linear array of chips, that is, would turn on a linear array of chips, the chips are already there, that would make a construction arm, and that would then begin to build the unit under construction out at the end of that arm, which is shown here as the green box in the upper right. Von Neumann's automaton consisted of a memory control unit, which von Neumann estimated to be about 300 by 500 chips in size. So 3 times 5 is 15, and 4 zeros after it, huh? So 150,000, something like that. That the construction unit would be about the same size, and the instruction tape, though different shape, would be about the same size, 150,000 chips. And the upshot was that the whole thing was about as complicated as a modern computer. So once that became apparent, it became obvious that nothing of this sort is going to happen by chance. Well, there were a number of attempts to simplify von Neumann's automaton after he had described how it would work. And in the midst of doing something of that sort, Christopher Langton discovered something much simpler than von Neumann's by modifying a small component part of a previously designed automaton so that just this little piece would reproduce itself. He designed a 10 by 10 loop with a 5 by 3 arm. And in this particular design, the instruction tape, we might call it, fits inside the loop and extends the arm by 6 units, and then has it turns left and do this another time and turn left and do this another time, so it repeats it 3 times till the arm collides with itself, breaks off a new loop then, so you've got now 2 loops, and makes new arms for each. He showed that he could design a automaton of this sort that reproduces in 151 time steps. Here's what Langton's simple automaton looks like at its starting point. A whole white field around this and the white field in the middle of this, we should imagine to be chips that are set at 0, but so that you can see what's going on, we've left out all of those and only left the zeros that are in the information loop. And so here we have it, and the ones are kind of just fillers in the information, and at each time step, the material inside this loop, that is the stuff between the twos, moves around counterclockwise, and when the sevens strike the end of the arm down here at the bottom, each one of them causes the arm to extend one step. And then when a sequence of 2 fours hit the end down there, see those back up at the top right of the loop at the moment, they will cause the arm to turn left And so the information keeps circulating in the main part of this thing, the loop part of this, and a copy of it branches off down the arm as each step goes forward. And so this produces the whole thing. Here's a picture here in this bottom panel where we see at the upper left in our black diagram the loop, and here the outer sheath, if you like, which would be twos, is colored dark blue, and the ones inside the thing are reds, and the sevens, I believe, are the whites, and the zeros are the blacks, so black is zero everywhere here, and the two fours are the greens, so you can see what's going on. And then the second picture from the top left shows it as the automaton is beginning to turn the corner the first time, and the next one is it turned the corner the second time, and the last one to the right in the upper shows it as the two loops have now formed, and then down at the bottom left, they have now separated, and each has a new construction arm. And then the next three panels show later generations going on. And the upshot basically is that a loop that is trapped in the inside so that it can't extend an arm in any direction then dies and becomes kind of red in this picture. And the loops on the outer edge that still are able to put out an extending arm continue to operate. And so shown in smaller and smaller scale, you can see what this looks like in future generations there. Well, that's Langdon's simple automaton. What can we say about this automaton in regard to its complexity? Well, let's see. I don't have anything about that yet. We'll come back and pick that up further on. John Bile created a simpler automaton in response to an article I'd written on Langdon's automaton. And here we see Bile's simpler automaton, which reproduces in 25 steps. Its only complication is that it really doesn't have much of an information loop, just really the four numbers 6, 3, 4, 6, or 6, 6, 3, 4, however you want to start the reading, in the middle. And it kind of just looks like it's mumbling along. You can't see quite what it's doing as well as you can with Langdon's automaton. But it does reproduce itself in the course of 25 steps. Mark Ludwig, after that, produced an even simpler one that reproduces itself in only 5 steps. It consists really of only 4 chips, 3 twos and a 1, and the 1, I suppose, is the information, if you like, and we can see it reproducing here in these 5 steps. The same sort of thing. It does the same sort of thing as Langdon's automaton it does. It sort of turns counterclockwise for the next generation, and in this case forms the new generation below the other one, so below where the other one was previously facing down, if you like. Well, attempts to calculate probabilities for random formation. In my article that appeared in the Perspectives in Science and Christian Faith, I made an attempt to calculate the probability of forming Langdon's automaton by random processes, and made a number of simplifying assumptions, some of which were very, very favorable to the formation of the thing. And you have to read that article to see the details on that. And I came up with a probability of Langdon's automaton forming the history of the universe was 1 in 10 to the -129. Well, John Bile came back with a response article, since I, at the end of that article, challenged anyone else to try and build something simpler and that sort of thing. He came back with his automaton, and he calculated his automaton would occur very easily. Well, in the counter article, I made an attempt to calculate the probability of forming his automaton using somewhat less generous assumptions than I had for Langdon's, still very generous compared with reality, and found that the probability of Bile's automaton forming a history universe was 1 chance in 10 to the 69, excuse me, which would be 1 × 10⁻⁹. Ludwig later constructed his simpler one, and his probability, his using the assumptions that Bile had that I had made for Biles would be that one would form every 10 to the minus 14 seconds, so would be very, very easy to form in the history of the universe, if you like. But again, responding with more reasonable assumptions, though still fairly generous ones, my calculation was one chance in 10 to the 1 times 10 to the minus 86, or one chance in 10 to the 86. So there it is, with some fighting back and forth on probabilities, and you would have to actually look through the articles to see the details on what assumptions are made of each of these probabilities. Well, what are the problems with these simple kind of automata? They're really not good for anything but reproduction, whereas most of what life we talk about does quite a few other things besides reproduce. They nourish themselves, typically move around, may have equipment for detecting other things in their neighborhood and things of that sort. The reproduction of these simple automata typically collapses with any kind of mutation. I've done some work on that with Langton's automaton, but that doesn't fit in here in our time in this particular talk. A viable automaton, one that won't typically collapse with any mutation, will need to be able to reproduce while the structure of the thing is changing. That is, not necessarily at the very moment, but need to be able to be, what should we say, flexible enough that mutations won't crash it, and won't crash its reproduction either. The upshot is that you need to add more chip states than we have in any of these automata, and that increases the complexity. An attempt has been made to make something more general than these three automata that we've mentioned, the Langton, Biel, and Ludwig automatons, and one of these we might call the life automaton. Here, an attempt was made to design an automaton that wasn't tied to a substrate, that is, to the details of how the transition rules and states of the individual chips or cells worked. Try not to tie it to a substrate that was especially designed for that particular automaton. So the suggestion was to use an existing substrate, and that was the substrate for John Conway's game Life. Anyone that's messed with computers much, particularly early in their history, would have been familiar with this particular game called Life. But when you actually do that, you find out the simplest reproducer is enormously complex, and it is in fact very much like von Neumann's. The upshot of this then is that these automata all face a problem of fragility. All of these automata we've mentioned run in an empty environment. What happens if they contact other objects in their space? Well, I've tested this for the Langton automaton, and the results are quite disastrous. The automaton is really too fragile to function in such a space. Well, that's a quick tour, a summary on automata. Universal constructors, that's what the original von Neumann automaton was. It would, depending on the information you put in the information tape, if you like, you could construct any kind of automaton, and if you, special case, if you put in certain information, it would reconstruct an automaton like itself, okay? Those are what we call universal constructors. They're way too complex to expect any of those things to happen by chance, if you like. Special constructors, the ones that make only themselves, typically are too specialized and too fragile to handle mutations. When you make a mutation in the thing, there's no reason to believe, one, that it will even not crash, two, that if it doesn't crash, it will reproduce, and three, if it does reproduce, it'll reproduce itself or something very close to it. So what you really need is to build automata that are general enough to be flexible, are robust, and not too complex to form randomly. And as far as I can tell from my studies in this, this looks to be impossible. Of course, challenge is open to anyone to construct an automaton that does do all of these things, and then see whether that's something that is at all likely to happen by chance. Well, we've been talking about computers. Now we come back to real life. So far, the Artificial Life Project is like the Biological Origin Life Project. Both produce some minor results, but these results have been hyped out of far out of proportion to their actual significance. I think of the one with the Miller-Urey experiment, where the production of a few amino acids was hyped almost like this was the first step in the origin of life, because it showed ostensibly that the early Earth atmosphere could produce amino acids. As the dust has settled in the now 40 years or more since the first experiment, we found that, one, the Earth's atmosphere doesn't look like it's the right kind of stuff to do anything like that, to produce amino acids, and second, that the even the experiment on those assumptions has not been able to produce all of the amino acids that actually take part in life. And beyond that, amino acids are only a very, very, very small step towards the formation of life. However, a problem of politics and finances, researchers realize you can't get funding if the funders think the project is hopeless. And so the hyping all out of proportion is actually a part of the selling process for getting things like this funded. But unfortunately, it also sells the public on things that we really do not have good evidence for. What all this means is that we should not mistake research proposals for results. Research proposals don't necessarily tell you what you're going to find. It will be of interest to see whether the Big Hadron Collider that has been built at CERN, and which is now about to be turned on as I make this audio for this lecture, whether that will in fact find the Higgs boson that they're looking for, or whether it won't. That's a research proposal. Will be quite interesting if we get the results, and if we don't get the results, that will be interesting too. Don't mistake research proposals for results. Don't mistake worldview-driven visions for a view of the real world. If your worldview is wrong, your view of the real world is going to be wrong. Even if your worldview is right, your view of the real world may be messed up badly because you've made some assumptions that really aren't quite right, even though your basic worldview is all right. The current results we've got for original life in the artificial life area look far more like evidence of intelligent design than they do like evidence that this is something that happened in a mindless universe. In a cartoon, in a sense, we can say it's like this. A fellow with a hand puppet moving the puppet around and somehow thinking that it's alive. Well, for further reading, I did an article, Artificial Life in Cellular Automata in Mere Creation, Science, Faith, and Intelligent Design, edited by William Dembski. You might want to take a look at that. That gives a little more detail than we've been able to give here. That's the end of our talk here. Will man-made simulations prove that life happened by itself? They might, but don't count on it. Thank you for your attention.